Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Whole Scoop Radio with your host, Carol Ferraci, your health and wellness resource, where you get the whole scoop and nothing but the scoop.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to The Whole Scoop. We are Health and Wellness Radio Show, where our guests are always highly credentialed in the fields and topics of discussion. The goal, of course, is this program is to provide you with bona fide, credentialed information so that you can make qualified decisions for your own healthcare needs. I am your host, Carol Ferraci, a registered licensed dietitian practicing for, oh gosh, well over 30 years. I hate admitting that, but it's true. You can find me at www.naturallynutritioninc.com. As you know, if you've listened to this show, you know it's important for me to provide you highly qualified guests. Tonight's show is Counting Sheep. How many Z's can you really afford to lose? And we're really going to talk about that because, seriously, I thought you could afford to lose some, and I'm not so sure anymore. So I'm going to remind you, I'm going to do the business here, I'm going to remind you that while our guests are highly credentialed on the topics of discussion, it's always recommended that you seek medical advice prior to implementing any and all interventions discussed on this program. The call-in number is 347-855-8894. That's 347-855-8894. You can also direct your questions and comments to our Facebook Blog Talk Radio group page. Please join us on that. Give us some feedback. Tell us what you want to hear. Tell us what you don't like to hear. Tell us what you're thinking. Give us questions. We're open for all of it. 347-855-8894. We will be taking questions a little bit later in the show. When you want to ask a question, remember to press the number one to get in the queue for questions. I will call out the last four digits of your telephone number. You know, if you're like what I'm about to tell you, 40 million people with sleep disorders and you've fallen asleep and I'm calling out the last four digits of your telephone number and you think that you're kind of hearing that in the background, you probably are. So think about that. So guess what? This is a special night tonight. We're broadcasting on our kind of – we do this on every second and fourth Thursday, but you know, if you were with us about a month ago, you'll know that we tried to broadcast this particular show, and it just didn't happen. And Dr. Hulan is just a fabulous, fabulous presenter, fabulous, well-versed. I mean, I can't say enough about this man, Dr. Raj Hulan. He's a physician. He's a surgeon. He specializes in trauma and orthopedics. His medical experiences include diagnosis and treatment of infectious diseases, neurological trauma, associated disorders, neurodegenerative diseases like multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, psychiatric disorders, personality and mood disorders, and his medical experience also includes diagnostic laboratory work, particularly in hematology. That really just kind of scratches the surface because I've sat through seminars with this man, and he just is a plethora of information, and you're in for a real treat tonight. And I am so grateful that he's here, and he was able to manipulate his schedule to be a part of this for us tonight and finally talk about this topic because it's so it's just so necessary. So with all that being said, let's bring Dr. Hulan on and say hello. Hey, Dr. Hulan, how are you?
Hi. I'm good. How are you, Carol?
So good. Thank you. And thank you so much for being here. And you know, I've had people tell me how much they were looking forward to this and how grateful they were that we were doing it so quickly again. So thank you.
Oh, well, that's my pleasure. And after that introduction, I'm kind of blushing here. I mean, that was a very lengthy and flattering introduction.
It's absolutely well-deserved. It's amazing.
Thank you.
I think I've said this the last time you were here. I told everybody that the last time that you did our show, we did it on the opioid epidemic, and I took copious notes, and I just could not get enough information. And then I had people the next 3 days telling me the same thing. So that intro was nothing compared to what you really are. So thank you. I'm just honored that you're here with us tonight.
All right, and we're going to talk about. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. We're talking about the sleep and sleep disorders and apnea and snoring and everything that goes along with it. And I think I mentioned in the intro that it affects 40 million people. And that's just
40 million
scratching the
people.
That's amazing. That's just amazing. I have to say that as of recent, I find myself in this category. There are times like in the middle of the day where I just find myself kind of nodding off, and that's never happened to me before. And it's a whole different experience when you feel a loss of, I don't know, I guess control, you know?
Yes.
And, you know, Carol, the thing of it is that this is not an isolated situation. A lot of people are actually experiencing the same problem. Why is insomnia so rampant today? That is the million-dollar question.
Yeah.
And
go ahead. Go ahead. Do we know why? I mean, do we have hypotheses as to what's happening?
Actually, it has a lot to do with the way we live our lives today, and I'm going to elaborate more on this as we go on. But if you were to talk to your friends, if you had a group of about 10 friends with you, I'm pretty sure that about 6 or 7 of them are going to tell you that they're having problems sleeping. So it's a larger change. It's the paradigm that we live in today. So let me start from what's happened with the latest Nobel Prize awards in medicine. I think we talked about this the last time when we were having technical problems. The Nobel Prize for Medicine has gone to 3 researchers who've been researching biological clocks. Right? So you may ask, what exactly is a biological clock? Well, when you consider that your sleep circadian rhythm is one of many, many circadian rhythms, it has to be regulated like anything else. This sleep circadian rhythm depends on cues from light and dark natural sources. But guess what? Living today, working the way we do, we don't work outside. We don't get the exposure to light and dark cues like our ancestors did. And so what happens is, being in a building all day long, we don't get to see the rising sun. We don't get to see the setting sun. And what happens then is that our sleep clock isn't set. So this biological clock for our circadian rhythm is not set. So we are defaulting to our intrinsic or genetic tendencies or cues for sleeping. And that's where most people are having a problem. Now, you did mention restless legs and a lot of other conditions that also cause insomnia, did you not?
Yeah, I did. And in fact, I have a list here. I kind of like didn't get to go down it, but normally that's how I start off a show. I didn't do that tonight. But yeah, restless leg syndrome, sleep apnea, insomnia, snoring. But the interesting thing was that when I was looking at things for this particular show, I was finding that people who had trouble concentrating as a direct result of a sleep disorder amounted to like 49.2 million. And people who had trouble remembering was like 38.8 million. And the number of annual car crashes due to sleep disorders or falling asleep is 1,550. And then the number of people who fell asleep during the day, out of those numbers, 37.9%. So that's a pretty significant number of people who are dealing with this on a daily basis. And when you talk about the circadian rhythm, which is the natural rhythm of the body saying it's time to sleep and time to be awake, and you put it in the context that you just did as it relates to how our days have actually changed and how our sensitivities have not really adjusted to the fact that we are more stimulated. How does this all come together? I mean, what is the research and what are people saying out there in terms of how to get some of this rhythm back on track? Because this is a huge number of people that's just going to grow, you know?
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. It's a huge number of people. And what's scary is that it crosses generations. You know, it crosses generations. So it's not just that you have one age demographic that's having this problem. So it doesn't really matter if you have sleep apnea or if you have restless legs or you just can't stay asleep. The common denominator here is you're not staying asleep. Right? So what leads to this? What's the problem? So I talked about the circadian rhythm for sleep and natural cues. So here's where it's all falling together. So as a society, as a people, with the advancement of technology the way it is, we are encroaching more and more into our nightly sleep time. We are, really. I mean, when you think about it, right? Now, your ancestors and my ancestors, they would go home, whatever their definition of home was back then, it was a place to retreat for the night. So when it got dark outside, they went back to these homes, and that's where they freshened up and had something to eat, and then they probably went to bed. So they were going to bed a lot earlier than you and I are these days. So as a result of that, Carol, you go to bed early, you know what's going to happen. You're going to get up early at some point during the night.
True.
And that is exactly what happened to our ancestors. They'd find themselves waking up at about 4 hours into their falling asleep, and they would get up and they would do stuff. They would do stuff for about an hour or so, and then they would lay back down for another sleep. They call it second sleep. So if you look at historical documentation or historical accounts, researchers like Roger Ekirch from Virginia Tech, Craig Koslowski, these researchers have documented historical accounts where people would record in their journals what they did during before they went to first sleep, how there were doctor manuals that would instruct young couples who were planning to conceive to have first sleep, and then after they gotten up, after the 4 hours of sleep, that's when they would try to conceive, if that's what they were trying to do, and then proceed with second sleep, which would be the second 4 hour period of the 8 hour sleep cycle. So that's the way people slept for thousands of years, right? So where has it gone wrong for us? Well, here's the thing. Now, because we don't have the exposure to light and dark cues, we have defaulted to our genetic tendencies for sleep, which are exactly like those of our ancestors. So you see the analogy here. So what happens is someone today goes to bed probably about 10-ish, 11-ish. Why? Because technology has taken over so much of our lives. We go from one computer screen to another, to the TV, to the iPad, to the smartphone. And by the time you're ready to go to bed, your mind is still racing. You're trying to sleep and it's really hard, right? But you do fall asleep. And then what happens? About 4 hours down the road, you find yourself awake. Now, if you're a medical person, that seems very much like insomnia, doesn't it, Carol?
It does. It actually does. You're right.
So
and if you're a medical person, you're going to diagnose it as insomnia, right?
Absolutely. So these people get up at, if they've gone to bed, say, about 11-ish, they're going to be up at about 3, and they're going to go, well, what the heck is happening to me here? Why am I waking up in the middle of the night? So instead of thinking that this may be part of a genetic pattern of sleep, that which our ancestors had, no, we are going to react in the opposite direction. We're going to react as if this is something bad, it's insomnia, and we should get it treated. So
that's
this is
true.
Where the problem begins, right? So then we talk to our doctors about drugs like Ambien or Zonata or any of these other drugs to help us fall asleep. And that's where the problem begins. So it's a larger change. It's an evolutionary change. It's because of the world that we live in, and it has upset our circadian rhythms to the point we have defaulted to our genetic tendencies for sleep. And, you know, this has been proven as well, Carol. I don't know if we got as far as talking about Thomas Weir the last time, but I am going to for the sake of our listeners, I am going to talk about Thomas Weir, who's another sleep researcher. The last name is spelled W-E-H-R. Thomas Weir conducted a very interesting experiment, Carol. He he did not subscribe to the fact that, you know, our physicians tell us that we need 8 hours of sleep in one block. He didn't subscribe to that. So here's what he did. He collected subjects, male and female, and he subjected them to 14 hours of darkness every day for 1 month.
Wow.
Now, it's pretty obvious what he's trying to do here. He was trying to get them to default to their genetic tendencies for sleep. He wanted to see how these folks would sleep after being exposed to 14 hours of darkness for 1 month. And you know what? After the month was over, it took a while for them all to normalize, but eventually they all started to sleep the same way. And guess what that was?
They woke up again in the middle of the night.
That is absolutely right. They had first sleep, a chunk of about 4 hours. Then they would get up for about an hour or so. Then they would lay back down again and get their second 4 hours. And you know what? If this is the way that you have to sleep to get your 8 hours, this is probably physiologically the best way to do it. People.
Well,
who
you know, I was just going to say to you, I was going to interject for a minute because I was going to say to you, this our medical norm says we must sleep 8 hours to get good, solid sleep. So what do we do when that doesn't happen? We're already conditioned to be anxious about that. We're already conditioned to say, oh my God, I'm not getting enough sleep. Oh, that's not going to happen. Oh, look at this pattern of mine. It's just horrible. It's horrible. It's horrible. And then we put ourselves into this high anxiety or over anxious state that just makes us not sleep. But if we listen to what you're saying and we go back to our ancestors, maybe there have been little shades of people who say if you're awake, then get up and do something, and then go back to sleep. That absolutely makes more sense than it does to become anxious and get ourselves wound up to a point where we're never going to sleep, and then we just we create a chronic cyclical process, and we go to our doctor and say I just can't sleep, I just can't do it. So not only do we get sleep meds, we get anxiety meds on top of that, and then that's a whole different ball game, right?
I think you nailed it. You nailed it right there, because it's not the lack of sleep that's the problem now. The problem has become the anxiety about the lack of sleep, and that's what perpetuates the insomnia. You nailed it. That is exactly what it's all about. So how are we going to take this knowledge? How are we going to take the fact that our ancestors slept in a totally different way for thousands of years until fairly recently and make it work for us? Now, I've done shift work. I've been on call in all my years of trauma, and so I've had to work nights. I got to tell you that human beings, and you know this, anyone who's worked night shift knows that human beings are not adapted to work at night. We're not. If you look at us from an evolutionary perspective, we don't have night vision. We don't have ultrasonic hearing. We have none of those adaptations, and yet we are required by society, by the terms of our civilization, to work to provide essential services at night. So we're basically working against the grain here, right? So I get a lot of complaints from shift workers that, you know, they try to come home after they've done with their shift, and they try to get 8 hours of sleep, and they can't for a number of reasons. Well, first of all, you come back after working a full 8-hour night shift, you're wound up. There's no way you're going to be able to relax enough to go to bed. Let's say that after a couple of hours of winding down, you decide to go ahead and do it. Well, you know, you don't live in a vacuum, and people are up and about doing things during the day. They're not going to allow you to get those 8 hours of sleep.
That's true. That's very true.
That's
and so
right.
Then what do? We get anxious because we didn't get enough sleep and we got to go back to work.
And we're sleep deprived on top of that, and we got to go back to work. So all the issues that you talked about, the anxiety, and even in the long term, depression become an issue, right? So what I've suggested to folks who work shift is very simple. It's an adaptation of what Thomas Weir did, and that is catch about 4 hours of sleep before you go into your shift. And then go into your shift, and when you come home after that, catch another 4 hours to make up your 8-hour complement. You'll find it a lot easier to catch increments of 4 hours of sleep than to get the whole 8 hours in one go. I'm sure you agree with me on that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great idea. I'll have to mention that to some people that I know that are working the night shifts and see what they're doing, but that's a great idea.
That is the best way to approach it. And I'll tell you something else, Carol. Who does it benefit if there is a lot of debate or controversy about insomnia? Who does it benefit the most?
The pharmaceutical companies.
The pharmaceutical companies and the people who make supplements. All the people who are in industry. That's my segue into the treatment of insomnia. So let's say you have a genuine concern. You go to your doctor. Your doctor will do one of two things. If your doctor is progressive, they will request a sleep study so we can nail the aspects of sleep that are problematic. If your doctor is not that progressive, they're just simply going to write you a prescription for some hypnotic or sedative hypnotic, and off you go. So
right.
Let's assume that you get a sleep study done and you find out what's wrong. Now, if there's an issue of sleep apnea that's keeping you awake, you'd be a fool not to address that, right? So go ahead and address the sleep apnea. If you need a CPAP or a bi-level PAP or a variable PAP, get that done.
Let's just define that for a minute so that everybody understands what that is and why they need to address it.
All right. So basically, there are many different types of sleep apneas out there. You've got the most common one, which is your obstructive sleep apnea. And then you've got one that's fairly rare, and that's called centralized sleep apnea. Let's talk about the most common one first. So obstructive sleep apneas are caused by excessive pressure on the airways or obstruction of the airways when you are laying in a prone, in a supine position. So if you're laying back, especially when you're on your back, not on your side, so what happens there? You've got a lot of soft tissue around your neck. So if you tend to be on the heavy side, that's going to put a little pressure on your airway, narrowing it, and then you're going to have that interruption in airway. Noisy breathing or a little bit of snoring, right? So that's obstructive. There are a lot of people who are not overweight or obese who also have sleep apnea. And these are people that have a very long, narrow, soft palate. And I know this is kind of hard to imagine, but your soft palate kind of dangles back there and falls into the airway when you're asleep. And that's what vibrates like the reed in a flute. I don't know if that's a good analogy. I don't play any musical instruments.
That's really good when you get
the ungodly noise that you get from some people, and weight is not even an issue there. The other one, the centralized sleep apnea, is a rarer situation. So this one is basically caused by a problem within the brain with your respiratory drive. For some reason, what happens is these people will stop breathing, and what happens next is there's a buildup of carbon dioxide in the blood, or what we call hypercapnia. As these hypercapnic levels start to go up, they get to a crescendo, and there is a critical level that will trigger the breathing response, and so then they gasp and start breathing, and that's when they correct the anomaly. They take in oxygen with that big sucking in and breathing fast and tossing and turning, and that fixes it. So those are the two kinds of sleep apnea that are out there.
So why is it important to address sleep apnea? What happens to people when they have, and let's just define apnea, in simplest terms, the definition of apnea is to, it's a want of breath, right? You want to breathe.
Basically the pure and simple definition of apnea is a disorder in which you repeatedly stop and start breathing. That's what it is. Going to your question then, so why is this a bad thing? Out of all the cells in your body, those cells that require the most and the most constant supply of oxygen are your brain cells. Your brain cells, particularly your neurons, are more oxygen dependent than any other cell in your body, even your myocardial cells of your heart. So any variation in oxygen delivery to those brain cells can cause a loss of cells or damage to cells potentially, right? So now this is not going to happen overnight. We're talking about sleep apnea that continues unaddressed for years, right? So every time you have an interruption in breathing, you also have a corresponding interruption in the supply of oxygen. So that's where you put two and two together. So over years and years of oxygen deprivation, these cells will deteriorate. How will you manifest as the person who's apneic? You will struggle with issues relating to memory. Everything begins with a problem relating to short-term memory, problem relating to factual memory. So all of these manifestations will start as a result of that.
So let's just take the person who is diagnosed with sleep apnea, and let's just, for all intents and purposes, call it the obstructive one, since that's the most common one.
Right.
They might have a CPAP machine, but, you know, I've never known anybody that says that machine is comfortable and that they can just, you know, sail right on. You're talking about putting a contraption on your face, hooking yourself up to a very noisy machine, and trying to sleep. So how does that relate, or how does that interplay to what we did when we started the show out and we started to talk about our circadian rhythm? I mean, how does that, doesn't it disrupt the circadian rhythm, and isn't that kind of like an oxymoron?
I think you've nailed it. It is kind of an oxymoron. Okay, so you're addressing the respiratory problem here with the PAP or BiPAP or CPAP. The CPAP basically stands for continuous positive airway pressure. A lot of people cannot get comfortable with CPAP, as you said, because that continuous pressure on the airway makes it seem like it's suffocating the individual, and they feel uncomfortable, so they pull the mask off. Variable PAP allows for release of some of that pressure, so it's a more amenable form of treatment for apnea. But that being said, whether it's CPAP or variable PAP or BiPAP, a lot of patients will use it. They will sleep through the night, or they will assume that they're sleeping well through the night because they don't wake up as much anymore. But there will be a fraction of those patients who will continue to have problems, right? So if, let's say, you have sleep apnea, but you also have lousy lifestyle habits, if you spend a lot of time on the computer, you don't go to bed at the right time, you have a lousy diet, and you eat too late in the night, all of these factors are going to combine to give you problems with sleep. So it's not just the sleep apnea. Sleep apnea does not occur in a vacuum. And this is a thing that we have to understand. So when we treat someone for sleep apnea, we have to look at the totality of the factors that surround their insomnia aside from the sleep apnea. This is why a sleep study is supposed to be so important. But you know what? I'll be honest with you, Carol. Today, when you go for a sleep study, you don't really get that multifactorial investigation. What you end up with is a de facto respiratory study. Most sleep studies have defaulted to examining and investigating apnea and nothing else.
So that makes sense, because it used to be, when they were doing sleep studies, it used to be a very extensive situation where people would go in and there would be all kinds of markers and tests done and whatever. And now it just seems to be commonplace. Yep, go have a sleep study. Okay, I'm done.
Yep.
Really, like, it's amazing to me, because they come out and they go, yep, I have sleep apnea. How many people are getting diagnosed with sleep apnea that don't actually have sleep apnea? Or is that even possible? I mean, if it's a respiratory function, or they're just looking at respiratory function, to me, just based on what you just said, to me, there have to be so many different variables involved with that, that the person reading the test, the person actually, how do you know the person that's doing the test at that particular time doesn't have sleep apnea themselves and maybe missed something? I mean, there's just so many variables that you just said to me that my head is kind of exploding on. So now, if I'm on track with that and you agree with that, then what is a person to do? What is the best solution to this?
I love it. Let me create an analogy for you to answer your question, all right? So you go to a sleep, you go to a sleep center to get a sleep study done, and how do you know that you're actually getting a valid assessment? As you and I have just both stated that most of the time what they do is they examine you for apnea and nothing else. But then there's so many different aspects of behavior and physiology that could be responsible for sleep apnea. But here's the thing. Look at the sleep clinic. Is it affiliated with a school or a university system? That's the sleep clinic you want to attend. You don't want to go to a private sleep research clinic because of the same reason why you want to be very careful when you go for dialysis, for example. I know it's a stretch, but I'm going to make a connection here. DaVita, that runs dialysis centers throughout the country, was slapped with an $800 million fine. And the reason for this fine was that they were paying kickbacks to physicians to get referrals for dialysis. I know that sounds terrible. But you know what? That's the world we live in today.
It is.
People do that.
And I will tell you that DaVita's mission statement, if you call them and talk to them, which I do pretty much on a daily basis and I'm put on hold, it is to become the world's greatest and best dialysis center ever. So there you have it.
You know, and that is the mission statement. But what I've just mentioned to you is not, you know, it's pretty common knowledge. It was in the press, and this is something that DaVita has publicly agreed to.
They acknowledge it, right?
So it's not, there's no controversy there at all. But I'm using it as an analogy. Now, what is there to stop a pharmaceutical company from latching on to sleep centers, funding them, or giving them some kind of an incentive to create a positive sleep study for someone, indicating that they may need some kind of medication as a result of that? You know, it's not a stretch. It can happen. But I think the larger problem, and we're digressing, the larger problem here is that the sleep studies that are conducted today are sleep studies light, rather than the true sleep study. You know, there was a time when you would get an EEG, right? So the EEG would trace brain activity levels, and that's how we would know that you're going through all the different stages of sleep and how many levels, how many cycles of sleep you got in a night. So this whole tracing was called the hypnogram. Hardly anyone gets a hypnogram anymore when they go to a sleep study, right? We also
it's a scare tactic, isn't it? Because it's like, oh my God, you stop breathing 132 times during, you know, the sleep study. Well, okay, did you? You know? Did you really?
Yeah.
Or how do you know that when you don't even know what the brain was doing? And based on how we started out this program, is some of that normal? You know, I don't know. I'm just asking.
Yeah. Well, actually, there is evidence. I mean, we have actually videotaped people who have sleep apnea to watch how they sleep at night. And you can see them not just once or twice or 10 or 20 times. Hundreds of times, they don't realize they're waking up. Hundreds of times, they're moving around, tossing, thrashing. And when you're doing that, you're not in REM. You know, you're not in rapid eye movement sleep because you don't have that sleep paralysis. What that tells the observer is that this person is sleeping at such a shallow level, probably stages 1 and 2, hardly ever into 3 and 4. And that's how they spend their whole night. That's not productive sleep. That's not physiological sleep. I think at this point, I would like to just very quickly explain to our listeners how a person is supposed to sleep normally at night. Okay, may I do that?
That'd be good. Yeah,
okay,
please.
So
that'd be great.
Well, you and I, when we fall asleep, when we lay down to sleep at night, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to kind of descend into a stage of light sleep. All right, so that's stage 1. Now, this is when you're just nodding off, but you can be awakened very easily. Doesn't last for very long, maybe about 15 minutes or so. Then you go into the light stage 2, which is, again, a stage of light sleep. But here you tend to be more asleep, and it's harder to rouse you from this stage 2. Okay, so here another 15 to 20 minutes or so, you descend into stage 3. Stages 3 and 4 are what we call your deep sleep stages. Right, so this is when your brain has completely slowed down. I mean, you've gone from about 20, 22 cycles per second. you're now down to about 1 to 2 cycles per second. All right, so the brain is taking a break. This is when your body is doing a lot of its maintenance work. And incidentally, mm-hmm. this is also when memory, factual memory, is being processed. Right, so this is a very okay. important phase. If you want to be able to retain memory, if you want to be able to retain what you're studying and all of that good stuff, stage 3, stage 4 has to happen.
Okay.
So now, when you descended into stage 4, then you start to go back up to stage 1, and then you hit rapid eye movement sleep. So over a period of about 90 minutes to about 100 minutes, you've finished one sleep cycle.
I see. Okay.
All right.
Wow.
Yeah. From there, you're going to have your next sleep cycle. And this one is really interesting, Carol. The next sleep cycle will be 1, 2, 3, 2, 1 REM. So you notice that stage 4 comes only once in the first 90 minutes or so of falling asleep. And you have to catch it. That's the thing. And not only is it important for memory, it's also critical for immune functioning, right? So immune functioning that happens in stage 4. So you have to have that. Let's say you went for your flu shot, but you're a lousy sleeper, right? It's almost guaranteed that you may not develop as many antibodies as you should, not because there was anything wrong with the vaccine, but because you're a lousy stage 4, because you miss stage 4 because you're a lousy sleep. So that's another thing that we could talk about there as well. So the next cycle that you had no stage 4, but you did get a stage 3. Guess what? The subsequent cycles after that will descend only to stage 2. So for the rest of the night, your pattern is going to be 1, 2, 2, 1. That's one cycle. 1, 2, 2, 1. Another cycle. And REM gets longer and longer. So I apologize. It's 1, 2, 2, 1, REM. 1, 2, 2, 1, REM. And all the way till you wake up in the morning. That's how you're supposed to sleep normally.
How many of us actually do that?
Well, it depends. Now, those of us that have good lifestyle habits, like what? Let's say you work in healthcare and you spend all day looking at a computer screen. The last thing you want to do when you go home is stare into another screen. So that's when you go and do something mindful. Relax, play with your pets, your grandkids, go do some gardening, have dinner early, cut out caffeinated beverages and foods before 6 o'clock, and take a nice warm bath before you go to bed, or a hot shower if you're in a hurry. And you do all these things that help induce sleep, and you're better off than everybody else. But let's say you did all of that, Carol, and you're still not sleeping well, and you go to the doctor to get a prescription. Now, here's the million-dollar question here. Are any of those prescription drugs going to give you natural physiological sleep? What do you think?
Yeah, I'm going to say no. I'm just going to put it right out there and say absolutely, I don't think so.
And I think if you had asked any of our listeners, they would have told you the exact same thing. The answer is correct. No, you're not. You know, that's the seduction of drugs. They're designed to do one thing, but they take away another thing in the process. There's always a give and take. So take the most famous of the prescription drugs today. The most widely prescribed would be Ambien. Ambien is a sedative hypnotic drug. It's what we call a non-benzodiazepine sedative hypnotic. It works on GABA, right? So you take Ambien and you fall asleep. There's no problem, no issue there. You will fall asleep. But are you getting physiological sleep? Studies have shown that you're going to get good stage 1, 2, 3, 4, but you're going to miss out on REM. University of California, Davis actually conducted an experiment with Ambien. So they got a group of individuals who were scheduled to take an exam after the weekend. So what they did was they broke the group of students into two categories. And one category, one group was given Ambien to sleep the night before the test. The other group was given nothing at all, right? So that was the control group. Which group do you think did better on the test the next day?
The one that had nothing?
That's the answer I get all the time. The real truth is the group that got the Ambien actually did better on the test. And here's why. Ambien enhances non-REM sleep. So stages 1, 2, 3, and 4 are really enhanced. And when do you form factual memory? I mentioned that a few minutes ago.
Stage four is
when you consolidate factual memory. That's right. So when it came to taking the test, they did really well because the Ambien actually helped them. And here's the sad part, Carol. That's where the study ends for the drug industry. And they used that study, Ambien, as an adaptive drug for sleep disturbances. But if you get a hold of that study and you read it all the way to the end where there's a disclosure, the disclosure states very simply in clear, precise language that any gains in stage 4 sleep were made at the expense of a loss of REM sleep.
And that's huge. And they just kind of just skirted right over that and went right for the marketing tool.
It is a very
common fact. Which is what they did with the statin drugs, which is a whole different show.
Yes. Very common.
Exactly what they did with statin drugs.
And,
you know, they took that little 1%. Wow.
Yeah.
So then let me ask you this. If, you know, given all of this information that we just talked about in putting everything together, the person that has, and I know we're concentrating a lot on sleep apnea. We haven't even talked about snoring or anything else. But we kind of have, but not really.
We can address that.
Go ahead. I just was formulating the whole question on, you know, there's got to be a better way. That's pretty much where I was going. There's got to be a different or a better way than what we're doing right now, because it doesn't appear as though that's actually working real well for people. Because if I have a machine that I can't use or that it doesn't work for me, then what am I gaining from that except more anxiety knowing that I should be using the machine, but I just can't do it?
You know, you're right. There is a better way. There is a better way to do it. So if you have obstructive sleep apnea, the machine is just one part of the equation, right? And I know you mentioned noisy machines. They're cumbersome. They're hard to wear. But there are newer generation of variable PAPs and CPAPs that are actually much smaller, much quieter. You just have to look for them. They're out there. Use the CPAP.
Okay.
But don't forget the other factors that we talked about as well. Now, the drugs. The drugs generally don't work. And I've said this before, and I'm going to say it again. If you're looking for salvation in the form of a pill, you're going to be very, very disappointed. There is no such thing.
And that's true about everything, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the seduction of drugs, you know. And most of our listeners who are boomers, they grew up in a period where, you know, drug companies were putting out newer and better drugs. And so we always look forward to the next generation of a drug. But we got to change that paradigm now, right? Now, the best drug out there is the one that you don't need, right? So your goal should be to try to cut out as many of these medications rather than add on to them. So what would I do then if a prescription drug doesn't work, it's got side effects, where am I to go? An old friend that we call melatonin. Now, here's the thing. Melatonin is naturally produced within the brain, within the anterior part of the pituitary, in an area that we call the SCN, supracortical nucleus, or it's the apparatus that produces melatonin. But melatonin doesn't just stay in the pituitary. It's the messenger that travels around a circuit that involves the pineal gland, the pituitary, and the hypothalamus, right? So this is the neurotransmitter or the brain chemical that perpetuates our sleep-wake cycle. Now, melatonin levels can go out of whack for a variety of reasons. If you go through a life-changing circumstance, or you suddenly go on an abrupt dietary change, or a time zone change, anything like that can upset it. So your best bet to try to regulate sleep would be to try to find melatonin that is analogous to what you make in the brain. So you go out and you try to find a good melatonin product. Now, that's your first challenge. because there are people out there, they want to sell you garbage
yeah,
in the name of supplements. So trying to find an over-the-counter supplement that's reliable is like trying to find a virgin in a maternity ward at times. I hope I don't offend anyone with that analogy, but, you know, I mean, it can happen, but what, once every 2,000 years maybe?
Again, that's a different show, but okay, yeah.
Yeah. So, well, here's the thing, all right? So let's say you do find a good product. Let's say you take it. Here's the thing that I get from people. If they come back and they say, I've been taking the melatonin and nothing happens, I don't see any change, obviously it's not working. But when I get someone who takes melatonin and they come back after a few days and they look me up and they go, oh, my God, I have never had such crazy dreams. I go, applaud, you know. Be happy,
yeah, that's
celebrate,
great, right?
Because you know what? You're actually sleeping, right? You're sleeping
yeah.
well, right? Now, but here's the thing, though. Even melatonin, if taken for an extended period of time, can be a problem. So you take the melatonin just like you would do, that you would take the Ambien or the Lunesta. The idea is these drugs were designed to get you into a rhythm of sleeping. Granted, you're not getting REM when you take the Ambien, but the idea behind Ambien was to get you into a rhythm of sleeping every night, and then when you've established a circadian rhythm for sleep, we gradually take away the Ambien, and off you go, and you start getting REM. That was the idea behind benzodiazepines as well. None of these drugs were ever designed to be taken open-endedly, and guess how they're being taken now? Everybody takes them.
Oh, yeah, you just take them forever.
Forever. Right. So now with the melatonin, take the melatonin, establish a circadian rhythm for sleep, and gradually taper it off. Because remember, you produce your own melatonin.
Right.
And if you continue to take an exogenous melatonin, there's always the danger that you might downregulate what you're supposed to produce, and then you become dependent on the melatonin that you're buying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point.
You know?
You know, that makes a lot of sense, though, because you know, I know just personally, I know that melatonin has had wonderful effects for people with dementia and, you know, even the Alzheimer's dementia, in that it helps to regulate that circadian rhythm again, only because they go through sundowners and all kinds of things. And the melatonin, just 6 milligrams a day, broken up 3 and 3, you know, 2 times a day, it actually just kind of keeps them at a point where they are much calmer and it's easier for them to kind of stay in that rhythm. So that makes a lot of sense. But nobody's looked at the long-term effects of that, like, you know, is there a cutoff time for even people with dementia? So that's great information. Thank you.
Well, and you know, I'm not so concerned about its use in dementia because, you know, with dementia patients, you know, you have certain limitations. But here's the other thing.
Right.
ADHD individuals, children who are put on these stimulant drugs, you know, either the Adderall-based Ritalin, the methylphenidate drugs, or whether they're on the actual amphetamine-based drugs like Ritalin, here's what happens. You give them the meds in the morning so that it helps them function in school. By the time the kid comes back, the drug is already tapering off. It's out of their system.
Yeah.
And so
right.
when bedtime comes, guess what? Your child is bouncing off the walls, right? And they're not able to sleep. So what do pediatricians do? They recommend to mom and dad that they give melatonin to these children so they can sleep at night. Now, what concerns me here is that you've got a generation of children whose brains are still developing, who are taking melatonin, and it seems to be open-ended. And that's where I have a problem.
Yeah. Good point. What about 5-HTP? I mean, Does 5-HTP enhance without long-term effects? Or
that's a very good question. And the first point we have to make is we have to assume that the 5-HTP you're buying is actually 5-HTP. Let's assume you've got a good product.
Now, yeah, let's go with that. Yeah.
For those people that don't know what it is 5-hydroxytryptamine, right? And what it is a precursor for serotonin. So 5-HTP, theoretically, when you take it, will cross into the brain and make serotonin. And serotonin is one of those brain chemicals that regulates your circadian rhythm for sleep as well. So the here again, the million-dollar question is 5-HTP crossing over into the brain in quantities sufficient to make the serotonin that you need? So far, what we know from whatever anecdotal sources that we have, because there aren't any real studies on 5-HTP that I'm aware of, so far what we know is that it may or it may not. It all depends on the product. Okay, so if you found a 5-HT product that is helping you to sleep, stick with it. But basically, that's the mechanism involved there. Before anything else, I do want to talk about a few other sleep
problems. We have a few minutes. Let's go ahead. And if anybody's got a question, you want to ask a question, press the number one.
Yeah, jump right in.
Yeah. Okay,
right.
So
now,
go ahead.
Legs, go ahead.
No, go ahead. You wanted to talk about some other things. Go ahead.
Oh, me?
Yeah, that's good.
Okay. I want to talk about restless legs really quick, all right, because I know there are a lot of people who are concerned about this as well. So let's say you lay down to sleep and you've got this creepy, crawly sensation in your legs that you can only get rid of if you constantly move your legs. So you're constantly moving and moving, and that's the only thing that can give you relief. Obviously, you're not going to be sleeping. So what is restless legs and what should you do about it? Well, we know that it's a motion type of a disorder. And the first thing that needs to be done for anyone who believes they have restless legs is we need to do a blood test, right? Now, a simple blood chemistry that includes iron levels. But here's the thing, though. Your doctor is just going to look at serum iron, and that's never enough. Because serum iron basically reveals the amount of iron that's being transported in the blood. What you want is a total iron profile, and that will include how much iron is bound, how much of it is being transferred, how much of it is in your blood. So you get the whole iron picture. And you know what? For most people that have restless legs, they have an iron deficiency, right? So you fix the iron deficiency, and that takes care of the restless legs. So that's your first thing that you have to do. Now, let's suppose you went and you had the blood test, your iron levels are normal, you've got restless legs. What's your next option? There are some interventions short of taking medicines that you can try. They say that massaging the legs before going to bed can help. You can wrap your legs, or you can put on a kind of a hose. That compression can also help. Let's say you've tried all of that and nothing works, that's when you go to the drug management. What are the drugs that are available? They're basically motion-affecting drugs. They're like Parkinsonian drugs, but not quite. So you have drugs like ropinirole hydrochloride. You have, that's your Requip, for those of you that are not familiar. You also have another one called Mirapex, right? So these are given for restless legs and periodic limb disorder. So that's another common sleep disorder that we encounter. Did you get any questions? Is anyone interested in anything else?
You know, I've got a bunch of callers on the board listening, and nobody's having a question. I'm not surprised. You're doing fabulous.
Either we're doing really, really well, or we put them all to sleep.
Yeah, they're probably all sleeping, and I should probably just try to randomly ask somebody if they're.
When you're talking about insomnia,
I don't think it'll let me in unless they actually push the queue to ask a question. So, anybody who has a question, if you're still awake, press the number one, and we'll get to you.
I know we've covered a lot of ground here today, but you know what? Talk about this again. I mean, there's just so many aspects to it. But sleep is a fascinating thing. I mean, you know, ever since the first study on sleep was ever done, William C. Dement, that's a name that's still being bandied around today. He's still around. William C. Dement is a researcher at Stanford, and he was one of the pioneers in sleep studies. I don't know if you remember this or not, but a high school student by the name of Randy Gardner still holds the record for staying awake for the longest number of days. I know there are other claims out there, but Randy Gardner's claim holds up because he was actually observed by William C. DeMent. And so how did Randy Gardner behave? So he stayed awake for 11 days and something, 20 hours or so. And after the 11 days, he gave a fully lucid press conference without, you know, slurring or anything like that. But what was interesting was that he had some problems. He would see things that weren't there. He would forget certain things he did. And when he did go back to sleep after staying awake for 11 days, he slept straight for one whole day, got up, and then went back to sleep, slept again for, I think it was another whole day, and then finally resumed his circadian rhythm of about 8 hours of sleep. The study on Randy Gardner still holds. I mean, it's an interesting study.
That is interesting.
I mean, if you get a chance, yeah, just Google it, Randy Gardner sleep,
okay,
and read it. It's fascinating.
That's great. Since no one's asking a question, and I've asked a few tonight, we have just a couple of more minutes. Why don't we do just a quick wrap-up as to, you know, maybe we should have started off the show with why sleep is important. I mean, we all know it is, and we all know that it resets our patterns, and you did touch on that. But what I'm trying to go for here is everything regenerates while we're sleeping, right? We're in a pattern of rejuvenating ourselves. So if that's happening, then it's important for us to get sleep, even right down to, like, if you've been diagnosed with diabetes, cardiovascular disease, anything, respiratory issues. There's a new study out, or actually relatively new study that I don't need to tell you about, I'm sure, but they found that blood platelets are actually initiated in the lung. Well, if we're not sleeping appropriately, we're not oxygenating ourselves appropriately, then how does that even happen? So everything kind of goes full circle.
I'm just going to interject.
Yeah, please.
And because we're running out of time, you're absolutely right. Not only does everything rejuvenate, it has to rejuvenate and replenish while we sleep. Every living creature sleeps. Every living creature sleeps. And that's how important it is. In experiments where rats were deprived of sleep, the longest they went out to was about 28 days, and then they died. When you have a very rare condition called fatal familial insomnia, that's what happens. You eventually die. So here's the thing. You need to sleep. So when you sleep, a lot of things happen. We talked about how memory is consolidated, how the immune system functions. But during REM, we talked about how stage 5 or REM, rapid eye movement sleep, is so important. Why is it so important? REM is when creativity is fostered. That's when the sensors to your thinking are down. You see, while we're awake, there are certain things we don't consider, certain things we don't think about, because we've got these censorship areas in the brain working. But when you go to sleep and you go into REM, these blocks, they're down. And so your mind is open to a multitude of different options. REM is also when you resolve emotional crises. People who take benzos like Xanax and don't get REM fall into a vicious cycle. You take the benzo because you're trying to get over the grief of losing someone, for example, but you don't get REM sleep. And REM is when you resolve grief. It's no surprise that in the DSM-5 now, we have a new classification of depression that is morphed from prolonged grief. So these people who continue to take benzos cannot resolve their grief. I'm not saying that you have to stop grieving, but at some point you have to become functional, and these people will never get there. And so that's a problem too.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. What a way to end the show. That's a lot of information, fabulous information. Thank you so very much. You know, you always give us a whole lot to learn and think about, and and move forward with. And you did a fabulous job tonight because everybody's just listening, and I'm actually getting people.
I had fun. Yeah, and I hope everyone
too.
Found it knowledgeable as well as fun.
Well, I'm getting some, you know, I've had some people text me while we were on saying, you know, I have them keep talking. That's what I had three texts coming back on, wow. So, you know.
Wonderful.
Thank you. There's nothing left to say to that except thank you very much. That's just it's incredible. So even though you didn't get a question, you had listeners for sure, and people were paying attention, and that's what we want. And
that's what we want.
You know,
absolutely.
That's great. And you have an open invitation to come back next year and be with us and do some different things. And we would love to have you back.
I would love to be back, and we will talk about dates at some point. Yes.
You got it. Thank you so much. Everybody, I'm going to say goodnight. I'm also going to say Happy New Year because we're going to we got the holidays coming up, and next week was supposed to be our week to broadcast. That's Thanksgiving, so that's not happening. And then it's been my experience on this show that December has not really been a great month for everybody because we're just getting ready for the holidays. So we're going to keep going here. We'll see you in January, and we're going to kick off the show with Susan Schatzer, who always is a great person. She's going to kick off 2018 with us and talk about how best it is to kick off a new year and how you as a person should look at the new year as instead of being tied up in torn up with all the old stuff. So it'll be fun, and we're going to say Happy New Year and Happy Holidays and all that stuff, and thank everybody so much for being with us in the whole scoop and telling us that you're still with us. We really appreciate it, and thank you, everybody, and thank you, Dr. Hulin, and we'll be back in touch to get you back on for 2018 as well, okay?
Thank you, and Happy New Year to everyone as well, and thank you for listening.
Thanks. Okay, good night, everybody.